Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vayishlach. This week, Rabbi Howard Marcos discusses Vayishlach. Rabbi Howard Marcos is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Howard Marcos.
Thank you, Larry. Our rabbis teach the following gematria, the art of deriving meaning from the numerical equivalent of Hebrew words. The gematria of the word for love in Hebrew, ahava, is 13. When two people love each other, their combined ahava in gematria totals 26. What unpronounceable word in Hebrew also has the gematria of 26? The answer? The tetragrammaton, the name of God, comprised of two heys, which is 10, one yud, which is another 10, and a vav, which is 6, giving us 26. When there is sincere love shared between two people, the result is one that has the potential to include within it a divine component. But not all love is heaven-blessed. In fact, there are three different models of love in this week's Torah portion: brotherly love, love which emerges as a result of unwarranted abuse, and love between a man and a woman. There is very little in common with these three emotions, except that the Torah has chosen to describe all three with actions and terms that well describe that intense emotion called love, without, in any of them, making reference to divine intervention. Let's explore these passages together in this podcast. When we think about expressions of love mentioned in our Torah, we might be reminded of the call from God to Abraham, "Kachna et bincha et yichidcha asher ahavta et Yitzchak." Take your son, your only son, the one whom you love, Isaac, and put him on an altar with the intention of sacrificing him to God. Or we may recall the arrival of Rebekah in Canaan, her meeting with her future husband Isaac, and their marriage, about which we are told, "Vayehaveha, vayinachem Yitzchak acharei imo." Isaac loved her, and thus found comfort after his mother's death. The fact is that there are not all that many places in our Torah in which love is both present and explicitly expressed. So it's quite interesting to notice that there are not one, not two, but three cases of love expounded upon in Parshat Vayishlach, this week's Torah portion. Please keep in mind that they are very different kinds of love at that. One that I would call brotherly love, another which I would label misguided love, bordering on lust, and the third instance which I would call marital love, the love between a wife and her husband. Follow with me today as we explore these different, very different, but all very important expressions of love in hopes of gaining insight into the psyches of our ancestors, as well as our own thoughts and feelings about this intriguing subject. Let's start with the stormy relationship that existed between brothers Jacob and Esau, twins who lost touch with one another when Rebekah, their mother, advised her favorite son, Jacob, to flee Canaan, lest Esau actually carry out his promise to kill his brother for having stolen his birthright at a moment of desperation. Jacob spent many, many years away from the family, and finally, after over two decades, he and his brother Esau were destined to meet. Would Esau still be holding a grudge? Was Jacob's life in danger in his agreeing to meet up with his brother? What would the reunion hold for Jacob and his family? Were they too in mortal danger? Jacob is so anxious about the meeting. The Torah text leaves us, I think, with the impression that Jacob is certain that his brother has not forgotten his promise to kill him at the first chance he gets. In other words, for over 20 years, during the time that Jacob was away from home, creating for himself a life filled with family intrigue, births and more births, and of course issues with the in-laws, through everything, Jacob still had the distinct feeling that his brother Esau didn't love him as a result of his having stolen the birthright and blessing of the firstborn right out from under his nose. That is the conclusion that one could derive when the last thing one knows about one's sibling is that he has vowed to kill you. He probably doesn't love you, right? Well, it's a bit more complicated than that, I think. Looking at the dynamics taking place in this week's parasha, we find Jacob quite nervous about meeting his brother. In Bereishit, Genesis chapter 32, verse 12, we read Jacob's plea to the Lord, "Hatzileni na miyad achi miyad Esav, ki yare anochi oto pen yavo vihikani eim al banim. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, else I fear he may come and strike me down, mothers and children alike." But you know, it may just be that the one who has chosen to run is holding on much more tightly to the words and deeds, and perhaps even the memories of the past, than the one who was wronged in the first place. In the heat of the moment of being robbed of his father's blessing, perhaps Esau did say some things that maybe he didn't really mean, like, "Yakumu yemei evel avi va'aharga et Yaakov achi." Let but the mourning period of my father come, and I will kill my brother Jacob. When word gets back to Rebekah, who admittedly considers Jacob her favorite, she helps her son pack so that he can leave their home as soon as is humanly possible. "Ad asher tashuv chamat achicha, ad shuv af achicha mimcha, v'shachach et asher asitalo." Until his fury subsides, says Rivka, until his anger against you subsides, and he forgets what you did to him. Little did Rebekah know that Esau would be much quicker to forget than Jacob, setting the stage for their first encounter after over 20 years. Do you know what I think? I think that deep down, Esau always loved Jacob, and his anger against his brother subsided as a function of the passing of time, even as Jacob was the one holding on to the past, unable to let go of the thoughts that his brother was still determined to kill him. Let's look at their actual reunion, reported in Genesis 33:4. Note, please, who is an active participant and who is passive. We are told, "Vayarots Esav likrato, vayichabkehu, vayipol al tzavarav, vayishakehu, vayivku." Esau ran to greet him. He embraced him. He fell on his neck, he kissed him, and they wept. Looking closely at this verse, only two things are certain: that Esau was the one running towards his brother Jacob, and at the end, both of them wept. As far as the subjects of the words, "Vayichabkehu," he hugged him, "Vayipol al tzavarav," he fell on his neck, and "Vayishakehu," he kissed him, the Hebrew is sufficiently ambiguous in its grammar that we really don't know who was doing the hugging, kissing, or neck falling. It seems that on the surface, it is left to you, the reader, to decide who is sharing his affection with whom. In the fantasy of a hope for total reconciliation, the medieval commentators very much wanted it to be Esau who was doing the hugging, kissing, and neck falling, and that is to where their comments allude. Rather, the machloket, the disagreement that prevails around Esau's seemingly gallant behavior, is whether or not he is sincere. With this question regarding Esau's sincerity comes the curious phenomenon of the six dots above the word "vayishakehu," he kissed him. In the Torah itself, if you look for this word in chapter 33 of Bereishit, you will find these dots which have been preserved in our Masoret, our Torah tradition, for at least 1,500 years. There is an axiom offered by the rabbis of Genesis Rabbah, one of our oldest midrashim, which some even estimate that it is from the 6th century before the Common Era, the 6th century of the Common Era, as to how we are to interpret the dots. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar. Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar taught, "If the letters of the word are greater in number than the dots appearing over the word, one interprets the dots. Conversely, if the dots are in greater abundance than the letters, one is to interpret the word." If the dots are equivalent in number to the letters, as in our case, in the word Vayishakehu, then they come to teach some novelty. Some commentators hold that the dots serve to make the word less significant. And of course, as to be expected, other commentators claim that the dots add to the word Vayishakehu. So with this explanation about the dots above the word Vayishakehu, he kissed him, we may conclude either that Esau's kiss was sincere and wholehearted, or that it was not. If we believe that Esau was still determined to kill Jacob, then the dots tell us that he changed his mind and was sincere in his kiss. If, on the other hand, Esau had already forgotten about wanting to do harm to his brother, then the kiss that is described that has six dots on top of the word might signify that not only was the kiss sincere, but even more than that, it was a result of a true brotherly love that Esau felt for his brother. Ibn Ezra, in his inimitable style, explains that the kiss was just that, a kiss. However we come to understand this scene, it might be worthwhile to stop for a moment and decide for ourselves what we want that kiss and the embrace to mean. Do we want the boys to get along again? Do we wish for them that the enmity will be completely set aside? Moreover, do we believe that the character Esau is capable of this turnaround? If we believe, as I do, that love between members of a family can survive even the cruelest of acts, then we can accept the sincerity of Esau's kiss. If, on the other hand, we are suspicious and untrusting of someone who is unpredictable and subsequently cannot be trusted to show sincerity, then we will find ourselves reading the dots, as well as this entire passage, like so many of the medieval commentators, believing that Esau was anything but sincere. It matters how we interpret this episode, I believe, because it has the potential to impact our own approach to family dynamics. We may find ourselves saying that our read of Esau's behavior might allow us to believe that his love for his brother Jacob was present and sincere at the time of their meeting. Similarly, our next get-together that includes an estranged family member or members might go surprisingly well simply because we have allowed ourselves to believe that a hello kiss is really sincere. There's more love that emerges in our parasha, and unfortunately this next love is as a result of what I would call misguided lust, which our antagonist perceived as love. This is the story of Dinah and Shechem. A man finds himself lusting after a woman, and, unable to control his sexual urges, forces her to have relations with him. While in 2 Samuel, Amnon, son of David, ends up hating Tamar after he rapes her, this same result is not at all apparent in our story of Dinah and Shechem. In fact, the text relates to us in chapter 34, "Vatidbak nafsho b'dina bat Yaakov, v'ye'ehav et hana'ara, v'yedaber al lev hana'ara." Being strongly drawn to Dinah, daughter of Jacob, and in love with the maiden, he spoke to the maiden tenderly. We, of course, may question whether the love was a true love, but once again, if we are able to take the verse strictly at face value, we would find that Shechem really and truly was in love with Dinah and would do anything in order to marry her. No sacrifice would be too great to make in order to make that relationship succeed. The text relates how Dinah's brothers Shimon and Levi take advantage of Shechem's blind love by creating a situation where he and the people in his town would all circumcise themselves as the condition by which a scheming couple of Israelites insisted be carried out if Dinah was to be given to Shechem to marry. There is absolutely no justification for Shechem's rape of Dinah. It doesn't matter whether after his act of violence he adjusted his attitude and behavior and professed a love for her. In the analysis of this expression of love, there is no room for tolerance. His act, like the behavior of any person that commits a violent crime, must not be ignored in favor of the romantic potential that might follow. This, then, is what I would call a love that was created from wrongdoing and cannot and must not be considered a reasonable kind of love. So far, we have looked at brotherly love and sinful love. Finally, I'd like to take a look with you at the third expression of love shared by characters in our parasha, namely the love shared between a husband and a wife. Jacob was married to Leah and Rachel, and he had two concubines with whom he brought more children into this world. And yet the text is very clear about who Jacob actually loved. There is no ambiguity whatsoever. Jacob loved Rachel. And while our Torah portion this week does not share that fact with us explicitly, we are told that in anticipation of his encounter with his brother Esau, Jacob lines up his clan, ready for a potentially deadly meeting, with Rachel and her small family at the very rear of the receiving line. Jacob saying, "Im yavo Esav el hamachaneh achat vihikahu, v'haya hamachaneh hanishar lifleta." If Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, the other camp, namely the camp of Rachel and her family, may yet escape. Jacob's desire to protect Rachel owing to his love for her is quite grounded in the Torah text. Their first meeting was not love at first sight, however. Consider what the Torah tells us when describing the first encounter between the two. We learn, "Vayehi ka'asher ra'a Yaakov et Rachel bat Lavan achi imo, ve'etzon Lavan achi imo, vayigash Yaakov vayagel et ha'even me'al pi ha'be'er, Vayashk et hatzon, et zon Lavan, achi imo. Vayishak Yaakov l'Rachel. Vayisa et kolo vayevk." When Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of his uncle Laban, and the flock of his mother's brother Laban, Jacob went up and rolled the stone off the mouth of the well and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and broke into tears. It seems, judging from the number of times that the yichus, the family connection between Jacob and Rachel's family, is mentioned during the report of this initial meeting, that Jacob was thinking more about how he misses his mother, whom he loved so much, than about this woman who is destined to be the one that he ends up loving the most. The kiss that is described by the text is not commented at all upon by our medieval commentators, almost as if to say that it was more platonic than romantic. David Kimchi even says that Rachel allowed Jacob to kiss her out of appreciation for his having rolled the stone off the well to enable the flocks of sheep to be watered. How completely unromantic a meeting. And yet over time, and with the understanding that their love for one another would develop and blossom quite intensely, our text then informs us a few verses later, when Jacob agrees to work for his future brother-in-law in exchange for permission to marry Rachel, that "Vayavod Yaakov b'Rachel sheva shanim, vayu ve'enav kiyamim achadim be'ahavato otah." So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and it seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. And if that was not explicit enough a description of their love for one another, the Torah offers yet another window into Jacob's feelings towards Rachel, one that leaves us a bit uncomfortable, but very likely gave Rachel reason to pause and appreciate her husband's affection. We are informed, "Vayehav gam et Rachel mileah, vayavod imo od sheva shanim acherot." Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah, agreeing to serve Laban another 7 years in order to be able to marry Rachel. The narrator wishes to inform us, almost taking the perspective of a neglected Leah, that Jacob already played favorites years before Joseph was born. Why could Jacob not have just loved Rachel? Why did it have to be at the expense of his relationship with Leah? Is this a commentary on the ills of polygamy, an act that was outlawed in Ashkenazic Judaism over a millennium ago, asserting that one cannot really sustain loving relationships with more than one wife? In summary, we have succeeded in delineating three very different facets of loving relationships. The question surrounding brotherly love is whether it can be sustained in spite of both unappreciated actions and the passage of time. The love that results as a consequence of an act of violence and abuse cannot be a love that is allowed to be realized. And the beautiful love between a person and his or her beloved, which makes time fly, in our case, or stand still, another manifestation of the intensity of love, can be the most powerful emotion ever experienced. Nevertheless, while the love may be sincere, it must not be allowed to be the cause of another person's pain. Our Torah portion, Vayishlach, allows the reader to observe the manner in which love is handled by the characters of the Bible. It requires rabbinic commentaries of later generations to turn the objective reporting of our Torah text into a series of lessons of morals and ethics, deciding which is a proper love and which is to be disdained. It is my hope and prayer that each and every one of us is successful in enjoying all kinds of love, and that it be healthy, pure, sincere, and a provider of only joy to those who are lucky enough to experience or observe it.
Thank you, Rabbi Marcos. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.